You're listening to Aperitivo, first broadcast on the 17th of October 2013 on Monocle 24. Aperitivo, brought to you by the Glenlivet. Hello from Midori House in London and welcome to Aperitivo, coming to you live from Studio One and from down the road at the Monocle Cafe. I'm Clemency Burton-Hill. Coming up on today's show,
he faces a lot of problems in Iran, both in terms of the economy, which is in turmoil because of the sanctions and the mismanagement of the previous administration. But apart from that, the hardliners.
Following those Iranian nuclear talks in Geneva, Gavin McFadyen and Rachel Shabby will be here in the studio with me to explain what progress was made and whether a deal really is on the cards. Also, with eBay's founder backing a new media venture with Glenn Greenwald, we ask if billionaire bankrolling is the future of journalism. Plus, we'll meet the guides of the hidden corners of the City of Light.
Tokyo is so far from Paris. We don't speak a word of Japanese, but if we succeed in Japan, we will be able to succeed everywhere in the world.
And later in the show, we'll catch up with Lisa Campbell of Broadcast Magazine for coffee and conversation at the Monocle Cafe. That's Aperitivo with me, Clemency Burton-Hill, right now on Monocle 24. It's a minute past six here in London. We have lots coming up in the next hour here on Aperitivo. But before we get underway, here's Paul Osborne with the latest news from around the world.
President Obama says the political crisis over the US budget has harmed America's standing around the world. After 16 days, the partial shutdown of the federal government has ended, with hundreds of thousands of employees returning to work.
Please, keep us government workers working. Yeah, we're serving here to serve the public.
I'm pleased that the Congress made some progress and that we were able to get something done, but I'm afraid we might be in the same place again in a couple of months.
Mr. Obama insisted the U.S. would bounce back, but he also warned voters wouldn't tolerate a repeat of the chaos of the last 2 weeks.
The American people are completely fed up with Washington. At a moment when our economic recovery demands more jobs, more momentum, we've got yet another self-inflicted crisis that set our economy back. And for what?
The deal agreed last night in Washington only guarantees U.S. government funding for the next 3 months. 15 people have died in a suicide bomb attack in northern Iraq. The victims came from the country's Shabak minority, who've been repeatedly targeted by Sunni militants. Elsewhere, at least 9 people died in a series of explosions in Baghdad. Chemical weapon inspectors in Syria say that for the first time they've been denied access to a site. Officials claimed it wasn't safe for them to enter. Despite that, the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons says it's pleased with progress so far, saying more than 20 sites have been inspected since a UN resolution ordering the destruction of Syria's chemical stockpiles. Almost 30 million people around the world are enslaved, according to a new report. The group Walk Free says it found evidence of slavery in all of the 162 countries it surveyed. More than half of the world's slaves are in India. Andrew Forrest is the founder of Walk Free.
That exploitation of the very, I think, weakest, darkest side of the human mind that is willing to totally abuse for exploitation of greed, profit, sex, whatever it is, another human being. And in our population, as we sit in the modern day world, there's never been the number of slaves, probably even collectively, as there are in the world today.
11 Nobel Prize winners have called on Vladimir Putin to drop charges against 30 Greenpeace activists and journalists. They were charged with piracy after a protest last month against oil drilling in the Arctic. The letter says the charges are excessive, but a spokesman for the Russian president insisted he had no power over the courts. Marine conservation activists claim thousands of dolphins have been illegally killed in Peru. They claim they're either used as shark bait or for human consumption. The killing of dolphins is outlawed in Peru, but Stefan Astermull, who's the director of one marine group, says that ban's being widely ignored.
It is clear that the entire fishing fleet for sharks in Peru is involved in a systematic killing of dolphins. The numbers are ranging from 7,000 to 15,000 dolphins per year, being very conservative.
That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, Paul Osborne. We'll see you again in about half an hour or so. You're listening to Aperitivo here on Monocle 24.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
位于伦敦，这是 Monocle 24.
Outlondo, tu vai Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London, London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Aperitivo, and the time here in London is 18.05. It's 13.05 in New York City. Well, joining me now with their take on a selection of today's top stories, I'm delighted to welcome to the studio Gavin McFadyen, director at the Centre for Investigative Journalism in London, and Rachel Shubby, journalist and author of Not the Enemy, Israel's Jews from Arab Lands. A very warm welcome to you both this evening. Thanks for joining us.
Hello.
Now, the news coming out of Geneva following 2 days of diplomatic talks between Iran and the US, UK, China, Russia and Germany is surprisingly upbeat. For the first time in years, Iran has hinted that it may be prepared to scale back contentious atomic activity in exchange for urgent sanctions relief. And for the third time in recent months, Iran and the US have held direct and openly acknowledged talks, which was previously a taboo on both sides. So what's caused this tentative breakthrough? I'm going to start with you, Rachel. What are your thoughts on how real a breakthrough this may actually be?
It seems pretty real. A lot of analysts are saying that the reason you know it's real is that the people involved in the talks aren't dissing each other to the media immediately after the talks, which is what they normally do, and that this proves that actually this time they're serious. The other good sign is that they've already scheduled the next meeting in 3 weeks' time, which is you know, another reason to be optimistic. But it seems that the main breakthrough has been in an agreement over the terms of the negotiation, meaning that Iran has always wanted the negotiations to include some kind of end point. What's the end game here? In the end, will we be allowed to continue with our enriched uranium program, albeit under supervision? We need to know that before we talk about the steps to get there. And it seems like the international community engaged in this has actually agreed to those terms for the first time.
And what about the terms? What about the demands being made by the international community to stop the enrichment of uranium, to export the existing stockpiles, and to suspend work at the enriched Fordow facility? Gavin, what are your thoughts on how realistic those demands are going to be now?
I think they'll be compromised, like everything else. Nothing is cast in stone. I think what is significant, though, is the causes for the détente. And we don't know much about that. At least I don't. Perhaps you do. I'm not sure.
But I did hear that apparently it was because of the foreign minister's bad back.
Yeah.
I mean, that sounds completely bizarre.
I think it's a spaghetti shortage. But I think that the actual reasons are, in most countries where there's been a huge blockade and a financial deprivation on a big scale, particularly to the poorest elements in that society, there may be significant worries about social unrest in Iran because of that. I mean, it happened in almost every country. There's been this kind of blockade. And this has gone on a long, long time. And although it's a wealthy country with a huge and skilled population, nonetheless, a very dangerous place, I think, for the leadership.
Now, Rouhani, the new president, was, of course, elected earlier this year on a promise to end needless confrontation with the outside world. But amid all of that cautious optimism that was generated by the possibility of a less isolationist president who might actually genuinely seek to move closer to the West, there were, of course, voices such as Netanyahu's who were calling for a reality check and saying, well, come on, he'll always be a puppet of Khamenei. You know, this isn't for real. How do you think news of today's potential breakthrough and, you know, the potentially imminent lifting of sanctions, which, as you say, Gavin, have been so punitive to the Iranian people.
They have, not to the leadership,
not
to the atomic energy program, but to the ordinary person on the street. It's been devastating. And there's a huge social cost to that, which can come home and bite you at any time. But I think more importantly with Obama, and I don't think it's an issue so much of a great peaceful tide that swept over him at night and he wakes up in the morning chanting peaceful slogans. I think what seems to be the case is that they can't fight wars on 15 fronts. Mm. You can't run 1,000 military-occupied areas around the world at the enormous cost it is and now start a war with a very big country. And Iran is a very big country. And I think, unlike Iraq, it could fight back. So I think there's a real danger there. And I think the military, for example, and we've learned from Cy Hirsch, the military, the American military, is not exactly enamored of the idea of a war with people who can fight back. I mean, they're very good against the island of Grenada, but they're not so great when it comes to a big, powerful country with a lot of resources.
Well, just in terms of taking the temperature in Iran and getting that sense of how people are reacting on the ground, a bit earlier, Monocle's Tyg Enright spoke with Mehrad Vezinejad. He's an Iranian journalist and commentator. Tyg asked if there was any surprise at how quickly things have moved since Rouhani took office.
I was rather pessimistic if he'll be able to do it. I still think there's a very long way to go. But one thing which everyone should bear in mind is that he faces a lot of problems in Iran, both in terms of the economy, which is in turmoil because of the sanctions and the mismanagement of the previous administration. But apart from that, the hardliners, he knows that he has a very limited, let's say, window that he can act upon. That's why he said in the UN as well that we're not going to have months, but weeks.
Why is it such a limited window?
Because, I mean, there are different voices. I mean, hardliners in Iran, they are obviously lost in the last elections. It takes a little bit of time for them to reorganize. It was a shock to them. No one thought that Rouhani would win it. Now, he knows that he has probably 3, 4, 5 months to, not to solve this issue, but at least to show to the people that we are serious and we have achieved something. He said at the beginning of his term that after 100 days in office, I'll report back to Iranians. And he wants to have something tangible to offer to Iranians after 100 days.
Rachel, what are your thoughts on that time bomb ticking underneath him?
Yeah, I mean, he's obviously under a lot of pressure from more extreme elements within his own country. That there definitely is a window of opportunity here, and everybody is aware of that. In terms of, you know, there are naysayers outside of Iran as well, as we know, Netanyahu in Israel being the sort of regional voice of doom about Iran for his own interests. I mean, the idea of Iran coming in from the cold and being diplomatically more friendly with the US and the West world is obviously geopolitically terrifying for Israel and shatters all its kind of, tenets of belief. And meanwhile, we have other nations like Saudi Arabia as well, very cross with the US. You know, why on earth would you want to get friendly with, you know, the great enemy Iran? So there are lots of forces conspiring against any sort of breakthrough in diplomacy between Iran and the Western world. But at the same time, there does seem to be a great deal of willing on both sides. And it's just a sort of race to see which of those elements will outweigh the other.
And Gavin, just to play devil's advocate, why on earth would the US want to get friendly with that great enemy Iran?
Well, I think there's a whole series of problems. They're military and they're financial. The United States is in a vast financial crisis. One forgets that they're so overextended in so many countries.
No kidding. 17th of October.
We know about
it. We really know about that today.
Well, I mean, so bad that, you know, to start another war and launch another huge, devastating financial crisis as a result of it, like we had with Iraq, is maybe too much even for them. And I think the hardline elements, as you refer to Iran, you could refer to in the States, I think they're on the defensive because there's cutbacks probably coming. There's all kinds of political problems for them, not the least of which is that their Israeli connection is also weakened. I think the Netanyahu game didn't work this time. And that must be quite shocking to their allies in the States and quite shocking in Israel, too.
They need a victory, don't they, in the Middle East? I mean, you know, they're going nowhere with Israel-Palestine. They're kind of really messed up on Syria. They need somewhere in the Middle East to work.
Well, in fact, they've messed up almost everywhere when you think of it. I mean, it's quite a comic sort of scene. I mean, Libya, what's going on there? What's going on in Tunisia? What's going on with the torture rooms in Morocco? I mean, it's, you know, you look at it, it's pretty grim.
So they really need this one to work out. Rachel, you mentioned that another date has already been set. What do we know about what might be talked about next? Indeed, what do we know about what was actually discussed over the past 2 days? Because some people are making the point that we know this is for real because we have no idea what they talked about. And things done in private are usually for real.
Yeah, that's what a lot of the analysts have been saying, that, you know, the fact that the paucity of actual information about what went on in those talks is a sure sign that it's serious. But one thing that we do know that it's discussed is Iran signing up to this sort of additional protocol that they actually did sign up to a few years ago. At that time, it was a European-led request protocol relating to supervision and monitoring of their uranium enrichment program. That was scuppered, I believe, by Bush, who just got fed up with the process, and it all fell apart. So actually, they're not being asked to do anything at the moment that they weren't asked to do and agreed to do 8 years ago. And you have to wonder why everybody had to suffer, you know, especially with these sanctions, 8 years of really punishing sanctions to really get to the same place that they were before and have the same kind of discussions that have already been had.
Mm-hmm. So tentative good news coming out of Iran. Let's move over to neighbouring Iraq. You mentioned, Gavin, the war in Iraq, disastrous for so many. And a shocking study out today from the US, which reports that around 500,000 people died from war-related causes during the conflict. That's they've timed that between mid-2003 to mid-2011. Now, this number far exceeds the 112,000 violent civilian deaths that had previously been reported by the British organisation Iraq Body Count. Well, as you can hear, still in the studio to talk through the implications of these numbers are Gavin McFadyen, director at the Centre for Investigative Journalism in London, and journalist and author Rachel Shubby. Gavin, are you surprised by that death toll?
Not at all. At the time that the Iraq Body Count numbers were published, they were very conservative and deliberately conservative. They only chose numbers that were actually printed in newspapers or that some UN official had seen in a morgue somewhere. But the huge numbers of dead people, particularly in the countryside, were very rarely accounted in much of that. What there was at the time, however, some years ago, was a major study done by The Lancet, which was quite famous. Everybody knows about this study because it said up to 1 million people had died. And of course, the study was ridiculed and all the rest of it at the time. Oh, couldn't possibly be the case, you know, couldn't possibly. And then we find out, of course, that now they think that the moderate figure may be 500,000, five times as much as we were told before. And if you see the films, for example, of mercenaries machine gunning people in city streets, machine gunning cars on the road, nobody counts those people. Mm. So you have no idea how many people were killed, for example, in helicopter gunship attacks in neighborhoods and all the rest of it. So I believe those figures entirely.
What's becoming clear, Rachel, is that so many of the deaths were caused by failures of health, sanitation, transportation, communication, other systems, which, again, might not be uppermost in people's mind when they're thinking about body counts in a war.
Yeah, I mean, that's the staggering thing about the post-invasion period, that there was absolutely no after plan. There was no thought to what would happen to Iraq the day after. And the sum of the information coming out of that era is just staggering, jaw-dropping. The lack of thought given to government structures, never mind other forms of infrastructure, power supply, healthcare, social services, all the kind of things that just fell apart in the vacuum following Saddam's fall, and which coalition forces have absolutely no idea what to do with afterwards. As far as they were concerned, mission accomplished was when Saddam fell, and there was no thought as to what would happen to the Iraqi people afterwards. And what we're seeing now in these figures, which are so high because, as you say, of things like lack of healthcare, is the devastating result of such little regard for human life in Iraq.
Gavin, do you think any lessons have been learned? Do you think this report will actually make people think twice, warmakers and policymakers think twice about the future and any conflicts they might undertake in the future? I mean, was Iraq a sort of lone example of that lack of preparedness?
Or? Oh, not at all. I think in Vietnam you had exactly the same problem where, you know, they lost a war and then they told everybody they won it. But the consequences were the civilian, about 3 million dead in Vietnam. Mm. Granted, a bigger war with a more prepared population and all the rest, but nonetheless savage. One interesting little window on the incompetence of it was the theft. And in Iraq in 2003 to 4, there was the largest shipment of money in American history to Baghdad Airport. It was on shrink-wrapped wooden pallets, millions and millions per pallet, and there were hundreds of pallets. It was in the billions.
From where?
From the United States.
Where was it going?
It was going to feed the new provisional government.
Right.
It was going to finance all the reconstruction of Iraq. And there was Italian money and French money, but largely American. And they claimed that a lot of that money was actually oil money that was kept away and be given to the new government to finance the government. But a huge percentage of that money vanished. It was the largest theft, we think, in recorded history. There was between $3 and $19 billion that went missing. And nobody knows, because there were no receipts. And the person in charge of the airport who was supposed to be collecting receipts didn't have any. So, I mean, with that, the guy gives you a window.
It gives you a window into the incompetence,
yes,
as you
does.
Say. Well, and that incompetence leading to those 500,000 at least deaths that we've been reading about today. Mm. Now, we're going to take a quick break. You're listening to Monocle 24. This is Aperitivo. But do stay with us. When we return, we'll be asking if the founder of eBay has stumbled upon a potential model that might just herald the future of journalism.
The rugged and romantic Scottish Highlands are not the Glenlivet's only inspiration. Since 1824, this single malt has combined unique flavours to create one of the world's most awarded whiskies. The Guardian's Chapter is their next limited edition whisky, with a taste that will be decided by the Glenlivet's own community of enthusiasts from around the world. To discover more and write the next chapter of the legacy, join the Guardians at theglenlivet.com. The Glenlivet. The single malt that started it all. Enjoy responsibly.
The Monocle app has all the details of what's coming up on Monocle 24 and offers you the chance to catch up on shows you might have missed. You can download programs to your mobile or tablet to listen offline and set reminders of all your favorites. It also has one-tap access to the latest news reports from our editors and correspondents around the world. The 2525 is Monocle's insider guide to the world's premier resort and business cities. The app features recommendations for the best hotels, restaurants, and retail opportunities, along with GPS directions, ensuring Monocle is your one-stop guide to city hopping. You can even give us feedback on personal favourites you've discovered on your travels. The Monocolumn is Instapaper supported and available to read on your mobile, fully integrated to fit any size and screen. The Monocle app is available through iTunes and at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Welcome back to Aperitivo here on Monocle 24. I'm Clemency Burton-Hill, and still with me is Gavin McFadyen, Director at the Centre for Investigative Journalism, and Rachel Shabby, journalist and author of Not the Enemy, Israel's Jews from Arab Lands. Well, it has been a rough ride of late for anyone who cares about the future of serious journalism. One such person is the tech billionaire Pierre M. Omidyar, founder of auction site eBay, who has spent years searching for the right media platform upon which to turn his munificent attention. Passionately interested in keeping governments accountable and accessible, he's already spent a portion of his $8.5 billion fortune on substantial grants for independent media outlets in Africa and watchdogs in the US. Now it's been revealed that he plans to launch a new watchdog journalism venture, partnering with the Guardian journalist, or the former Guardian journalist, I should say, Glenn Greenwald, and filmmaker Laura Poitras, whose names became synonymous with the Edward Snowden affair earlier this year. Gavin, good news for journalism today?
Yeah, I think excellent news. But of course, there's nothing extraordinary about billionaires financing newspapers. I mean, what's different in this case is the man's a liberal, and that immediately attracts your attention. Also, the choice of Glenn Greenwald is an extraordinary idea. But this has happened before. In Britain, some years ago, John Pilger was put up to be the editor of a putative Sunday paper, and it fell apart, sadly. Because they didn't have a professional infrastructure to handle what was a very interesting editorial package they put together. And let's hope, I think, in his case, in California, that they'll be able to do a rather better job of the infrastructure. Mm. Because $250 million, which is the quoted sum, the maximum sum, is pretty good money.
It certainly is. I mean, there are journalistic outlets around the world slavering over the thought of $250 million thousand, let alone million. I mean, Rachel, in terms of what he's actually wanting to achieve here, and he appears to be merging both his philanthropic instincts, which we've seen in former ventures of his, as well as a business interest in journalism, into what seems like quite an ambitious operation, especially in these times. Do you have high hopes that it can succeed?
Well, there's certainly a hungry market for it. I mean, as we know, the idea of millionaires, billionaires funding journalism is nothing new. Just look at the UK media landscape. It's almost entirely funded by, you know, porn barons and family hierarchies and Russian ex-KGB billionaire agents.
No names.
So, you know, it's not new. What's new about this guy is that he's one of, you know, he's actually looking for probing, honest, investigative, fearless journalism of the kind that Glenn Greenwald has been doing for the past 5-6 years. So, that is the thing that's different about him. And there is a hunger for that kind of journalism. We know that. We constantly hear that from readers bemoaning the downgrading of the media landscape, the fact that it is so consumed by corporates and business interests and therefore does not stand up to the very people that it should be holding to account. These are things that we're always hearing the public complain about. And here's this guy saying, well, you know what? I want to set up a media organisation that is entirely, that has that as its premise. I think that's great news and very encouraging.
Something odd about it, though, which was that he also wants to handle the news. That's unusual because the news is very expensive. You either buy it in and you edit it and present it, or you have your own people out there doing it. And there's an interesting case in the form of a woman in America called Amy Goodman, who runs an extraordinary news operation. It's really an aggregate operation, but it's of a very high quality. It's called Democracy Now!, and she has 1,300 outlets in the United States. In other words, more than any operation in Europe, and yet she's never heard of here. And there's no European equivalent to that because all the media here is either state or corporate in large measure. Mm. So you don't get these independent, crazed and wonderful figures producing really interesting news. What's interesting about this is this guy has serious money. Mm. So suddenly this could be all over the landscape in a big way. There are a lot of people in the American media who are very unhappy about what they have to do and how they do it.
So as a model, there is, I mean, this thing about, you know, billionaire saviors. As a model, you know, it's still, you know, it's not exactly the solution. I mean, this guy is liberal and has good intentions and therefore we're enthused by it. But as a model, you know, that isn't necessarily the thing that's going to save journalism.
But also, what model is he really proposing here? It's going to be a news-only website, general news website, whose real chief aim is to pry open official secrets. Do we know if it's going to be, is there going to be a paywall? Is it going to be free to everyone? Presumably it's, you know, in keeping with the philosophy, you'd think it would be free to everyone, but we know that that's not necessarily a sustainable position in this climate. So
I don't think they have a position yet. I think they're still negotiating a landscape that's very complicated. I mean, even the only successful news website in the world, really, that has news on it rather than porn is The Guardian, which is extraordinary.
But they are losing money, hemorrhaging
money.
I mean, literally hemorrhaging.
It's hemorrhaging money, exactly. And that's why I don't think that's a plausible alternative.
Well, the most successful model is the Daily Mail,
but
unfortunately.
That's porn. Yeah. I mean, people only read it to see all these amazing things on the right-hand column.
As a business model,
precisely
that's
what we're getting away from. So in terms of what's facing him, though, the challenges are extraordinary, and it doesn't matter how good the journalists are, it doesn't matter how noble the intentions are. Actually, what he's facing is a media landscape in which nobody yet knows how to make money from online journalism.
So far. But on the other hand, there are huge numbers of dissatisfied people in interesting little pockets around the United States. Mm. The largest investigative operation in the world is in Berkeley, California, called CIR. And that's funded to the tune of, I think, $70 million. So it's a substantial operation in its own way, a third the size of what he wants to do. But they bought a local newspaper. They have television programs, radio programs, all the rest of it. None of it's seen, of course, in Europe. Mm. But in the States, it's widely known. They work with 60 Minutes and with the New York Times. And it's an effective operation. And there's another done by another billionaire in New York called ProPublica. And that's also funded to the tune of $35 million. But it's effective and successful.
Rachel, we know that Mr. Greenwald, Glenn Greenwald, of course, has a huge trove of documents from Edward Snowden that relate to government surveillance and other secret matters. He's made it clear that he's got a lot more of where that came from as well. Is there a risk that this becomes a kind of one-trick pony, that the site becomes, you know, that's all it's there for, and that's people will go to it for that? But in terms of general news, as you say, you know, it might not be that people... That wouldn't be the first port of call.
No, I don't think so. I mean, from what I understand of what's already, what's been discussed about this new venture, and obviously very little is known in a concrete sense, but it doesn't sound like it's going to only focus on that. It has made that an operational premise, that it is about investigative journalism, that it does want to hold institutions and governments to account, which, you know, is the primary reason for being a journalist, but it has said that it will need to do all kinds of other journalism, entertainment, sport, etc., in order to be a kind of, you know, proper media organisation. So I don't think there's any risk of it running out of steam anytime
soon.
Nor material.
I mean, I think there's a lot of material out there. There's an old saying of Mr. Assange's, which is courage is contagious. And once you see this effective website out there publishing amazing quantities of material, I suspect there'll be more whistleblowers, more troublemakers. Mm. Well, one hopes so, because that's the lifeblood of democracy. So one hopes that it'll take off.
We're going to have to leave it there. Thank you both so much for joining us here at Midori House. Big sentiments to leave on there. Let's hope so indeed. The future of journalism perhaps just got a little bit brighter. Who knows? Gavin McFadyen, director at the Centre for Investigative Journalism, and Rachel Sharby, author of Not the Enemy, Israel's Jews from Arab Lands. Wonderful to have you both on the show. Thank you so
Thank
much.
You.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Tu vai Monaco 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tóquio.
London, New York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monaco 24 desu.
Londrina, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monaco 24.
It's just gone 6:30 here in London. Plenty still to come in the second half of today's Aperitivo. Next, we'll be meeting the founders of A Guide to the Hidden Corners of Paris and hear about their expansion plans in Japan. We'll also be heading over to the Monocle Cafe at some point to chat with Lisa Campbell of Broadcast Magazine. But before we get underway with all of that, here's Paul Osborne with the world news headlines.
President Obama says the political crisis over the US budget harmed America's standing around the world. It's ended after 16 days, with the partial shutdown of the federal government coming to an end and hundreds of thousands of employees returning to work. 15 people have died in a suicide bomb attack in northern Iraq. The victims came from the country's Shabak minority, who have been repeatedly targeted by Sunni militants. Chemical weapons inspectors in Syria say that for the first time they've been denied access to a site. Officials claim that it wasn't safe for them to enter. But despite that, the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons says that so far it's pleased with progress, with more than 20 sites inspected. Almost 30 million people around the world are enslaved, according to a new report. The group Walk Free says it's found evidence of slavery in all of the 162 countries that it surveyed, though more than half of all the world's slaves are in India. And 11 Nobel Prize winners have written to Vladimir Putin, calling on him to drop charges against 30 Greenpeace activists and journalists. They were charged with piracy after a protest last month against oil drilling in the Arctic. The letter says those charges are excessive, though a spokesman for the Russian president has insisted he has no power over the courts. And those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much indeed, Paul. We'll see you again at the top of the hour. You're listening to Aperitivo on Monocle 24. The time is about 18:33 here in London. Now, what started as a simple e-newsletter revealing the best-kept secrets of Paris to a small group of people is now big business, and all without a drop of funding or marketing. With more than 1 million subscribers, My Little Paris is the place to go if you want to know where to find the last umbrella repair shop, say, or a restaurant where there's only one table. Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco met the commercial director of My Little Paris, Céline Aujubin, to discuss their latest developments, including an expansion to Japan. He also spoke with Guillaume Declerc, chief editor of Merci Alfred, the male version of My Little Paris, which already has a reach of 150,000 subscribers.
Céline, tell me about your plans. You've been expanding to Japan now.
Yes, exactly. Well, we've just launched our box
in Japan. You know, last time we were talking about My Little Box, it's basically a surprise box you can subscribe and receive each month, a box full of surprises and gifts. And we've just launched it in Japan actually 2 weeks ago.
And how different is to work with the French market and the Japanese market?
Well, actually, everything is different, you know. I think Tokyo is so far from Paris. We don't speak a word of Japanese, but if we succeed in Japan, we will be able to succeed everywhere in the world. So yeah, it's kind of challenging for us. But at the same time, our illustrator, Kanako Kuno, is Japanese. And we have the feeling that there is something very close, you know, in her drawings. She's been drawing Parisian women for 4 years with a Japanese sense. So yeah.
And there is a certain fascination of the Japanese with Paris, right?
Of course.
I mean, they're probably one of the biggest tourism marketing in France as well.
Yeah, and actually our media, My Little Paris, I think actually having Paris in your brand name is actually one of the greatest assets you can have. Paris still attracts a lot of tourists, so yes, of course.
And all those boxes, they were sold out, or...?
Yeah, well, the first box we've launched, it was actually La Parisienne box. So the idea is really to capture the Parisienne woman essence in a box. We launched 2,500 boxes in Tokyo. They were all sell out, like in, I think, 24 hours, actually. So yeah, we're very happy with this launch.
Well, an interesting move, you know. I mean, in the same kind of group, may I say, you have some sort of like a My Little Paris for men as well. I have here Guillaume Declerc. Can you tell us more about Merci Alfred?
Yeah, exactly. So Merci Alfred, well, it's kind of hard to pronounce in English. Merci Alfred means thank you, Jeeves, basically.
Thank you what?
Thank you, Jeeves, because like Jeeves is the name of the butler. So we want to be the butler helping our readers. And so, yeah, we're a newsletter targeting young Parisian affluent guys. And it's become a big success now in France. We have more than 150,000 readers and very engaged readers.
And I was reading your site today. I mean, it looks incredible, like My Little Paris does. And you have some very interesting things, like you have an infographic of facts about Paris, for example, where a single man could be lucky somehow as well.
Yeah, exactly. So we've learned something that what makes our guys read, engage and share is when they learn something or really have fun. So yeah, we're designing a lot of infographics now on the website. So one infographics about giving, you know, unknown facts about Paris. And this infographic about Paris was a huge success. For example, the guys learned that there were like six women for five guys in the western side of Paris. And it was shared so much. We had 300,000 views in just 24 hours, which is really great for us.
And you had a quiz like if you're a hipster or not, a true hipster.
Oh, yeah. This is really... Yeah.
I'm curious. I want to do it myself.
Yeah. Well, you should. It? You should. Actually, yeah, this was just kind of a joke, you know, between us. But we said, all right, so if we laugh, maybe our readers will laugh too. And we launched this infographics. It was also shared like so many times, and all the newspapers in France were even talking about it, you know. So it was really crazy, good experience for us.
Do you remember a question of that quiz that you
Yeah. Well, I don't know how you translate it in English. The first question was, do you wear like a hat, a bonnet, I think you call it in English, but even when it's warm? And if the answer is yes, of course you're a hipster.
I don't, so
that's good.
Not a hipster, but I have to see the other ones as well. So what are the plans for the future, Guillaume?
So we're now, you know, only focusing on Paris, mainly giving off the beaten track addresses about Paris, but we're launching a national edition, mainly on iPhone first, and we'll focus on giving content tailored for men. So like basically, you know, jokes and infographics. And we have a lot of hope for this new business.
And Celine, coming back to you, do you feel, for example, that some men are visiting My Little Paris and vice versa, some women are checking Merci Alfred?
Well, yeah, actually, we have 5% of our readers at My Little Paris who are men. They want to really sneak, and they have the feeling that they're like looking at the women drawers, basically. So they're here to find new tips. And on Merci Alfred, we have 15% of women.
Yeah, actually, we have quite a lot of women because they want just
they're more curious.
They want to sneak into the, you know, the life of the guys. And you know, we also found out that some girls actually like what the guys like too, like, you know, going to a bar and drinking beer.
Of course, and I guess, and what about Celine? Any other cities or countries you want to explore after Japan?
Well, I think maybe London actually would be our next step. But for media, we think that there is a lot of things to discover in London, and we might launch My Little London quite soon.
That was Céline Orjubin of My Little Paris and Guillaume Declercq of Merci Alfred talking to Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Well, it's 18:39 in London. Time now, I reckon, for a bit of music, and we're going to stick in Paris for that. This is Françoise Hardy with Le Temps de l'Amour.
On s'en souvient.
Inimitably sultry tones of Françoise Hardy with Le Temps de l'Amour. You're listening to Aperitivo here on Monocle 24.
The Glenlivet was the first single malt to successfully cross the Atlantic Ocean. And since that first journey, the world-renowned whiskey has never looked back. Now, master distiller Alan Winchester is inviting their global community of whiskey connoisseurs, the guardians of the Glenlivet, to help create their next limited edition whiskey. To discover more and write the next chapter of the legacy, join the guardians at theglenlivet.com. The Glenlivet, the single malt that started it all. Enjoy responsibly.
In Istanbul, they took to the streets in a battle for green space. In Sao Paulo, they marched in their thousands in a fight for cheaper buses. In Athens, they shouted loud to demand a better-run capital. And every week in London, there's a rollerblading convoy that reclaims the streets for the pedestrians and pedal pushers. That's why urbanism matters, why words like density, infrastructure, and smart cities need to be dragged out of city hall conclaves and turned into a public debate. And that's why every week, Monocle's show, The Urbanist, reports from cities around the world that are getting horribly wrong and deliciously right, visits the mavericks and mayors with a vision further than the edge of their desk, and asks the questions that will shape how we live tomorrow.
To me, placemaking is a sacred community process. It's about an organic way that communities can evolve and shape the spaces that are important to them.
Every 20 years, the city gets rebuilt. There's probably not a lot of cities in the world that gets rebuilt every 20 years.
People respond to variety, and cities need a richness and diversity.
Oh, and we take time to savour the softer side of metropolitan living too, from the need for playfulness to places to pause in the melee. Presented by me, Andrew Tuck, The Urbanist premieres every Thursday at 1900 London time, and you can also download it from monocle.com or iTunes.
Welcome back to Aperitivo. The time is 21:44 in Moscow, 18:44 here in London, and 14:44 in Rio. Well, it's time now to head live to the Monocle Cafe just down the road on Chiltern Street, where Monocle's news editor Tom Edwards is, I believe, grabbing coffee with Lisa Campbell, editor of Broadcast Magazine. On the agenda tonight, the BBC's World War I centenary and a new play on conversation. Evening, Tom. Over to you.
Evening, Clemmie. Yeah, that's exactly where I am, in the Monocle Cafe. We're indeed enjoying some coffees and other beverages besides. I'm with Lisa Campbell. Lisa, welcome to the programme. Let's start by talking about BBC's World War I centenary. It's always interesting when these big anniversaries roll around, exactly the kind of shape and character that the sort of events to mark it are going to take. And a really significant sort of array, a huge depth and variety of coverage planned. Tell us some of the sort of the highlights, I guess, that we're going to be looking forward to next year.
There's an amazing array. I mean, I almost don't know where to begin, really, because it's the biggest and most ambitious collaborative season of programmes that the BBC has ever undertaken. So there's about 130 original new commissions, and it amounts to some 2,500 hours of content, and that's going to be across radio, TV, online. It's going to be regional, national, international. And it's going to run over a four-year period, and the scheduling will really echo the timeline of the World War.
And it's intriguing, isn't it? Because it is one of those things, when you think of these sorts of events, they were, by definition, international in their nature, and it's such a logistical challenge to reflect that, to draw in all those disparate elements. But I guess everyone probably within the institution is pretty optimistic that they'll be able to hold it together. It's amazing, I think, isn't it, over 4 years to keep reflecting the events that happen. It's an incredible logistical undertaking, I guess, if nothing else.
It is, and I think it's something that only the BBC can undertake, really. The number of platforms it's got, its global standing and reputation, its channels all around the world, the fact that people buy all over the place from lots of BBC output. And I think it's really interesting because they're sort of saying, you know, it's not just going to be a historical sort of chronological boring documentary sort of thing. It's really looking at how this has had a dramatic impact on shaping who we are all over the world. I mean, it's a war that's touched everybody. It's defined generations. It's, you know, we all know people who are in the war, and sort of how it's touched everybody. And they're going to be looking at, you know, the psychology of war, the morals, the industry, military issues. There's some amazing dramas. Particularly, there's one called The Great War Diary, and this is the BBC and 25 broadcasters from around the world, and they've come together to produce this big global event, which is telling the story solely through the eyes of those who lived it. So it's inspired by letters and journals from the Great War, and it follows the individual stories of 13 characters, and their writings are woven into one compelling story. And so as this was the first truly global war, the diaries are global as well, and they hail from all the, you know, the powers, all walks of life, represent a real cross-section of society. So I think that's going to be a really interesting look, something that's never done before. And I think another interesting one is modelled on something called Our War, where we've seen modern soldiers in Afghanistan having these helmet cams, and we've seen the war from their perspective right on the ground. Now, they're going to be reenacting that in the trenches, in the World War I situation, but with the new technology. So this will be, you know, amazing new perspective that we'll get. So I think all of this is about trying to bring something new and different, trying to sort of reassess and look at the impact now, introduce new audiences to it. There's going to be lots of, you know, there's children's programming, there's music, there's docs, there's drama. There's going to be news bulletins every morning on Radio 4, you know, following different events. I mean, it's immense.
A huge range, in fact. And I know that one of the subjects of one of the pieces will be a certain Keith Murdoch, father of Rupert, of course, who I think it's fair to say hasn't always enjoyed the most agreeable of relations with the BBC. So I guess at least if we're talking about reappraising history and reappraising attitudes, that's one to note, certainly.
It is, and it's actually a clip of that, and it's very moving. I mean, he definitely comes across as a human being, and he's, you know, shedding tears at his thoughts on that.
Well, it's going to truly be breaking barriers. Let's move on and talk a little bit about a conversation. Given that we're having a conversation, let's talk about the art, the practice art of conversations. There's a new play out, which I know you've seen, based on this book from the 1920s about well, I guess how to talk with poise, with charm, with personality. It's gone onto the stage. How does that work? Because if it's just about the art of conversation, is it just people talking, or is it slightly more complex than that?
It is, I mean, it almost shouldn't work. It's a one-man show. Nigel Barrett has created this with Louise Mari, who. They're behind Shunt, which is another experimental immersive theatre company. And he literally stands there, dressed in colonial attire, reading from the book. And then there's moments of blackout where he then puts into practice what he's been reading, the lessons of how to be witty and engaging, and involves the audience in that. So it's brilliantly done. I mean, it's a fantastic performance. He really has the audience sort of in the palm of his hand. He you know, the slightest move prompts hysteria. And the book is very amusing, and it's clearly it talks to an audience of Ethel Cotton, is, you know, refined British, you know, very sort of upstanding lady, and this is sort of talking to an audience like that. But of course, we're 21st century multicultural audience, so some of the teachings in this are really sort of quite shocking for us, but it does force us to reflect on our attitudes now towards gender and ethnicity and nationality, and just how far we've come. It really speaks about the legacy of empire.
Well, let's take a listen to it, at least try and get a bit of a handle on exactly how it sounds. I think we can hear some of it now. Let's tune in.
Do you like or dislike a person on site? What method is valuable in identifying a disturbing person? Why is it necessary to overcome race prejudice? How many adjectives can you use in describing a mountain? What particular things annoy your friends? Which of the following may be the cause of your unpopularity? Is it A, your personal mannerisms? B, your lack of ideas or dullness? C, your unpleasant voice?
So that is the sounds of a conversation, and just remind us, Lisa, that is playing for a few more days at least, isn't it? In some, well, in London, nearby?
It is. It's at the Yard Theatre in Hackney, which is a really great place for new artists and new ideas. It won a Fringe Award at the Edinburgh Festival, and I think it's really well worth seeing.
Well, there you go. If you're in London, next few days, I think it's on until this weekend, so do tune in. Lisa, just before we go, very, very briefly, I know that Broadcast is hosting some sort of conferences, production and post-production forums. Exciting times. It'd be important to sort of get the message out there.
Yeah, this is a two-day conference at the BFI, and it's really looking at new technology in television, but also going behind the scenes in a lot of depth about some of the greatest shows. So things like Downton Abbey, Great British Bake Off, all the favourites. We're going to be talking to the biggest names behind those and really the secrets of their success.
Fantastic stuff. Well, more information, I'm sure, available through, people can check on Broadcast website. Fantastic stuff. That is Lisa Campbell. Lisa, thanks as always for coming to join us. Clemency, plenty of food for thought there. Back to you in the studio.
Certainly is, Tom. Thanks very much indeed. You're listening to Aperitivo here on Monocle 24. It's 18:53 in London. That means we're fast approaching the end of the show. But before we hear what's still to come tonight on Monocle 24, we have a very special check-in now with our editor-in-chief in New York, where he's celebrating the second anniversary this very day of the launch of Monocle 24. Good afternoon, Tyler.
Hello, Clemency.
What an exciting day.
Kale salads all round for everyone in New York today.
Wonderful stuff. 2 years in, Tyler, I mean, this is all your vision. Is it what you expected?
Very much so. And it's this is that time of year, Clemency, when it's planning period for 2014 as well. So as much as we're here on the day happy birthday announcements, you know, back bouncing around the company, I sort of feel we're already at the end of quarter one 2014 and thinking about all of the new things that we're going to be adding to the mix as well.
Can you give us a hint of any of what those plans might be for the next 2 years and beyond?
Well, we've got, we have our Sophie Grove Femi installed in Istanbul, so we're opening up a bureau there, and you know, like we've done in so many other places. So Istanbul, of course, will be fully wired and tuned in, and I think will, you know, really give us a unique voice, you know, in the region. This is also going to be our staging post for the Middle East as well, you know, in the form of Caleb Lauer and Joseph Dana. You know, and then with Sophie there as well, we have three very strong people now sitting in the region. And of course, Istanbul is just a very good base to deploy people from. So I think we'll be hearing a lot more from that part of the world. And we're in North America. We're looking at the U.S. West Coast. There could be some possibilities for a presence there. We've never had a proper bureau presence. And we're also looking at Southeast Asia as well. So I think in terms of rounding out the day, there'll certainly be a few more studio points around the world.
And just briefly, Tyler, before we move on, just tell us, how many are listening to Monocle 24 and in how many countries?
Well, I think, you know, core countries, when we look at traffic, we focus on a sort of a top 20 or 25. But we're at the point right now where we're about 1.7 million programs now downloaded every month. So if we look at Monday to Friday in terms of our daily news and current affairs programs, the likes of The Globalist has really become a franchise in its own right, a most listened to program. But then classic shows of the weekend, like The Monocle Weekly, do incredibly well. Sophie Grove's program, The Entrepreneurs, hugely successful. Listenership at USA leads the way, an incredibly important market. So we're also doing an event here in New York tonight, doing a book signing at the McNally Jackson, and then hosting a little party afterwards as well. So this market, both in print, but also what happens with audio as well, continues to lead the way.
Tyler, we're going to have to leave it there, but a hugely happy birthday to everyone involved in Monocle 24. We're all very proud to be part of it and have a wonderful party tonight and a wonderful book launch. Tyler Brulé, our editor-in-chief, on the ground in New York City. Well, we're going to have a very quick taster now about what's coming up on tonight's programmes here on Monocle 24. I'm joined in the studio now by Barbara Feeney, producer of The Globalist Asia, and also our resident Parisian, Daphné Denis, who's heading up the Monocle Daily tonight. Lovely to see you both as always. Barbara, we'll start with you. What's up on The Globalist
Asia?
Good
evening, Clemency. So we're starting off, we are looking again at the crackdown of Chinese corruption, because the mayor of Nanjing is under investigation. So, since Xi Jinping came into power, he's really kind of been cracking down on corruption. So we are going to be taking a look at that. We're also going to look back at the life of Hans Riegel, who is the head of Haribo, and he died this week at the age of 90.
I have to confess, we were tucking into a few Haribo gummy bears earlier in commemoration of his life.
The man, yeah.
Definitely tell us what you've got on this show.
We're going to start with Turkey-Israel relationships after there's been an article that's saying that Erdogan blew the cover of Mossad agents in Iran. This was leaked by the Washington Post, so it may also have a strong impact on the Turkey-US relationship. So we'll be talking about that with our own Joseph Dana from Istanbul. And we'll also discuss whether the debt ceiling crisis has been successful for Obama, despite the fact that he says that there are no winners in this crisis at all. And we'll end with a package on moose. Moose are disappearing, and it's rather sad, but we'll discuss the science behind it and why they're disappearing.
Amazing. Who knew? Maybe there needs to be a Haribo gummy moose or something to raise awareness of their plight. That's The Globalist Asia, produced by Barbara. That's will be at 2000 hours London time, and The Monocle Daily at 2200 hours. Thank you both very much for joining us. Well, it's fast approaching 7 o'clock in the evening here in London. That means it's all we have time for on today's Aperitivo. My thanks in particular to our special guests, Gavin McFadyen, director at the Centre for Investigative Journalism in London, and Rachel Shabby, journalist and author of Not the Enemy, Israel's Jews from Arab Lands. Today's show was produced by Daniel Giacopelli. It was researched by Alexa Firmenich, Andrea Alacon, and Maddie Araujo. And our studio manager was Chris Chilvers. Next after the headlines is The Urbanist, presented by our very own Andrew Tuck. And here's a little taste of that show.
If that's got a roof on it, that's fine. If it's got 20 stories of housing, it's got more action and more people around in the neighbourhood. So density is less important than the functional activities that take place within the building.
Thanks for listening.
A Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.